and wrong. Is there an ultimate standard? If so, where does it come from? Or is morality merely subjective? If there is a moral law, how do we know it? And anthropology is our beliefs about human nature. The most powerful illustration of a paradigm shift I have ever encountered is the story Stephen Covey tells of a time when he was on the subway. A dad and his young kids stepped on, and the kids immediately began misbehaving. They were bothering everyone else on the train, and the dad was doing nothing about it. Covey and the other passengers started to get irritated. They couldn't believe the father was allowing this to happen. How insensitive. Does he even care about the other people on the train? Does he even care about his kids? But then, the dad looked up and said something that literally transformed everything. "I'm so sorry about my kids. We just came from the hospital where their mother just died. I guess they don't know how to respond. And neither do I." That changed everything. Instead of questioning this father's sensitivity and ability to parent, Covey was immediately flooded with sympathy. Why? Because his paradigm was changed. The story he was telling himself before was that this man was just inconsiderate. After all, that's how things appeared. From that way of seeing things came his irritation, his attitude. But that was the wrong story. When he got a different story, the right story, his attitude immediately changed. That's the power of paradigms. And that's also the challenge of paradigms. They can be true. They can accurately reflect reality. Or they can be false. Our paradigms are not reality itself. They are our maps of reality. And any map can be more or less accurate. The wrong maps will lead to wrong attitudes and wrong actions. It is therefore imperative that we get our paradigms right. Why addressing paradigms is essential for creating change. Since our paradigms are the root of our actions and attitudes, then by definition, in order to change our actions, we can't simply address our actions themselves. We need to change something deeper, the source of our attitudes and actions. We must address and change our paradigm. As Covey notes, more essential than working on attitudes and behaviors is examining the paradigms out of which those attitudes and behaviors flow. In other words, if we want to create significant change in the results, we can't just change attitudes and behaviors, methods, or techniques. We have to change the basic paradigms out of which they grow. We have to change the way we see the world. Hence, the solution to the gap between what we want to do and actually are doing is not found first in the right methods, for the very problem is embodied in the assumptions behind the methods themselves. The solution is in identifying the assumptions behind the methods and going to the root. Addressing paradigms is remarkably effective. It is far more powerful than just making tactics and behaviors more efficient, because it goes to the roots. Addressing paradigms is the key to increasing your effectiveness in, ironically, the most efficient way. Covey explains this very well. How do we become more effective? I have found that if you want to make slow, incremental improvement, change your attitude or behavior. But if you want to improve in major ways, I mean dramatic, revolutionary, transforming ways, if you want to make quantum improvements, either as an individual or as an organization, change your frame of reference. Change how you see the world, how you think about people, how you view management and leadership. Change your paradigm, your scheme for understanding and explaining certain aspects of reality. The great breakthroughs are breaks with old ways of thinking. As the paradigm shifts, it opens up a whole new area of insight, knowledge, and understanding, resulting in a quantum difference in performance. Covey gives several examples that illustrate this. There was a paradigm shift in medicine when they discovered that infections are caused by bacteria. The Declaration of Independence expresses a paradigm shift from seeing government as an imposing overlord to a government that derives its powers from the consent of the governed. And during the Middle Ages, there was a shift away from believing that wealth came from gold to realizing that it came from industry. In our own lives, most of us have experienced the power of a paradigm change when our role changes. Focusing on our frame of reference is where the true power to change comes from. Covey says, "I submit that if we focus our attention on techniques, on specific practices, on to-do lists, on present pressures, we might make some small improvements. But if we want to move ahead in a major way, we need to shift our paradigm and see the situation in a totally new way." Approaches that ignore paradigms may help somewhat, but they fail to meet the deepest need because they aren't looking at the roots out of which the fruit in our lives is growing. They will not ultimately get us unstuck. When we try to change the behavior or the method without changing the paradigm eventually overpowers the change. That's why so many attempts to install things, like the management flavor of the month, in organizations are unsuccessful. For humans, change can't be installed. It has to be grown. Change then emerges organically out of the paradigms. This is part of the reason some terms like paradigm and empowerment got a bad reputation and were slotted as mere buzzwords. Companies started trying to implement them not by going to the root, but superficially. They were looking for quick fixes, and the result was that they completely misused the concepts. The irony here is that these efforts were therefore doubly unproductive. By seeking to change merely through tactics, rather than by addressing the roots of behavior, not only was the change undone, but there was a backlash causing even more harm. Being unstuck is about fundamental change, not just short-term or superficial change. Fundamental change comes from addressing the issues of what you believe and what you love. That is, worldview, the roots out of which the fruit of our lives grows. How discipleship happens. Understanding the place of paradigms also helps us understand how Christian growth and sanctification happen. Many have been pointing out more fully recently that Christianity is not about behavior modification. What do they mean by that? First, they mean that Christianity is not just about our behavior at all. It is ultimately about a relationship with Christ. You can have great behavior, but you are missing everything if you do not know Christ and have fellowship with Him. John 17, verse 3. And Philippians 3, verses 7 through 11. Second, they mean that Christianity is not just about external change, or changing from the outside in, but rather is about changing from the inside out. That is, it is about heart change. True and lasting change happens from the heart. Matthew 15, verses 10 through 20. Romans 12, verses 1 and 2. And understanding paradigms helps us see more clearly how that happens. Change in our actions happens as change in our character happens. And change in our character happens as our paradigm changes, as our way of viewing and feeling changes. Eric Geiger sums up the inside-out nature of discipleship well in Transformational Discipleship. Discipleship is transformation, not information overload or behavioral modification. When transformation occurs, there is an increasing hunger for more knowledge of Jesus and His Word. But the primary focus of acquiring knowledge must be the ongoing renewal of the heart. When transformation occurs, behavior will follow. But the focus must be the heart, or the behavior is self-manipulated and short-lived, as opposed to flowing from the transformation offered by Christ. So transformed affections and beliefs lead to transformed people. How are affections changed? They are changed from an experience of God's grace in regeneration and ongoing beholding the greatness of Christ. And we all with unveiled face, beholding the glory of the Lord, are being transformed into the same image from one degree of glory to another, for this comes from the Lord, who is the Spirit. 2 Corinthians 3, verse 18. Time management must address worldview. And so, when it comes to our time management and the way we lead our lives, we need to address our worldview, our paradigms. What paradigm is governing the way you view your time management? The urgency addiction we saw earlier is an example of a paradigm. Either urgency or importance is going to be your chief paradigm for how you make decisions. How character enables you to make good decisions. How do you know what is important? Importance is something even deeper than your own goals. Important things are things that align with correct principles and God's truth. And that takes us to the heart of why character is essential to productivity. For principles bring us into the realm of character. There are two sources for knowing correct principles. First, the scriptures. Blessed are those whose way is blameless, who walk in the law of the Lord. Psalm 119, verse 1. And second, we have the capacity to discern correct principles through our conscience, which is directly informed by our understanding of the scriptures. We have an inner compass that enables us to detect what right principles are. The way to put first things first is to build this inner compass, that is, our character, so that we are able to discern what right principles are and desire to follow them. Character enables us to see and understand correct principles so that we can base our lives and decisions on them. That is why character is central to true productivity. We then can articulate our mission and values flowing from those correct principles, and our personal vision can become an accurate way of identifying what is important. This is at the heart of time management, and why productivity is rooted first in character, not techniques. For it is character that enables us to discern what is important and use the techniques well. Change must be grown, not installed. We can see from these things that we must understand that change is grown, not installed. It is grown because, as we saw previously, there is something behind our attitudes and behaviors. True change focuses there, rather than trying to rigidly install or force change from pure acts of will. This gives you power to actually make the change. And since worldviews and mindsets do not change overnight, change cannot just be dropped down from the sky. It is a process. Thus, mistakes that come about as you do your best and stretch yourself but fail must be forgiven. For if change happens through a process, that process will include trial and error, and thus we must allow for mistakes. Change takes time, which means that efficiency must take a back seat to effectiveness. An efficiency mindset will kill the crop, and it will kill the goose that lays the golden eggs, trying to get them all at once. Many change efforts in organizations and among individuals fail because of efficiency mindsets. We see efforts to install change, a hallmark of the personality ethic, in the business world when, as Covey summarizes it so well, executives seek to buy a new culture of improved productivity with morale boosters, smiling training, and external interventions, all the while ignoring the low-trust climate produced by such manipulations, as they are when divorced from character. When that doesn't work, they look for the next personality technique, not realizing, or refusing to admit, that it's the fundamental paradigm that's wrong. Such techniques are based on the willpower fallacy we saw in Chapter 3. Our attempts to install change rather than grow it is a huge reason we get stuck. If we want to change, we can't focus on immediate attitudes and behaviors. We have to focus on what is driving those things. We need to think like farmers, not factory foremen. To get unstuck, we have to go after real fixes, not quick fixes. Real fixes address the roots, and so are long-term and take more time at the start, but less time down the road. They deal with character. Quick fixes address the symptoms and not the roots in an attempt to save time. They are quicker at the start, but they don't really address the problem. So it comes back, thus taking much more time down the road. With these things understood, we now have the equipment we need to identify what important means so that we can truly make our decisions on the basis of importance. The essence of character is humility. What is the heart of character? Humility. Humility is the operating principle, and it has two components. First, humility means seeing yourself as nothing in comparison to God. John the Baptist said that he was not even worthy to untie Jesus' shoes. Luke 3, verse 16. Paul said, "Neither he who plants nor he who waters is anything, but only God who gives the growth." 1 Corinthians 3, verse 7. And God said, "This is the one to whom I will look, he who is humble and contrite in spirit and trembles at my word." Isaiah 66, verse 2. The second component of humility is seeing others as more important than yourself. In humility, count others more significant than yourselves. Philippians 2, verse 3. In doing so, you will seek the good of others over your own good, as Paul then goes on to say, "Let each of you look not only to his own interests, but also to the interests of others." He bases this instruction in the gospel, saying, "Have this mind among yourselves, which is yours in Christ Jesus, who, though he was in the form of God, did not count equality with God a thing to be grasped." Philippians 2, verses 4 through 6. And so humility seeks the good of others. John Dixon expresses this in the best way I've ever seen. Humility means that you hold your power for the good of others. With humility, you begin to see everything you have as a stewardship to be used for God's purposes, not your own, and you seek to benefit and serve others with everything you have, just as Christ does. Philippians 2, verses 5 through 11, and 2 Corinthians 8, verses 9 through 15. If you have influence, you use it first to advance others, not yourself. If you have authority, you use it to protect and serve, not make yourself feel important. Thus, the operating principle for our productivity is humility. And with that humility comes love. Love is humble, and humility includes love. The power of humility is faith. What is the power to have humility? Faith that God is working for you. Being centered on God takes faith and is the same as living by faith. We see this relationship between faith and humility in Habakkuk 2, verse 4. "Behold, his soul is puffed up. It is not upright within him, but the righteous shall live by his faith." This is what Paul quotes in Romans when he argues that justification is by faith alone. Romans 1, verses 16 and 17. In Scripture, there is a relationship between humility and faith. Since humility is about holding your power for the good of others, there is a relationship between faith and love. This truth, interestingly, sheds light on why justification is by faith alone. "So that no one may boast." Ephesians 2, verse 9. See also Romans 3, verses 27 and 28. Paul is saying here that justification is by faith so that people may be humble. Or to put it another way, that everyone may love. So once again we see, as discussed in What's Best Next, that justification by faith apart from works is the root of love. That is, character. And thus, truly effective living. The Unstuck Clinic. Core point. Getting unstuck is about fundamental change, not surface-level change. Fundamental change is the only change that truly lasts. To change fundamentally, we have to change from the inside out, not outside in. This comes from addressing our paradigms, the way we see the world. Exercise. Think of a time you were driven by urgency. Write it down and describe it. Then, think of a time you acted on the basis of importance. How did things go? What made it possible for you to do that? Part 2. Personal Leadership. The Compass. Getting Your Life Unstuck. Where there is no vision, the people perish. Proverbs 29, verse 18. With the foundations in place, we are now ready for the second phase of getting unstuck. Personal leadership. This is our compass, the way we know the right direction to head. We have heard a lot about leadership in terms of leading other people. Hundreds of books are published on the topic every year, which I think is a good thing. When people say, "There is already so much on this subject, why do we need more?" I want to reply, "Start reading the books, and you'll see that there's always more to learn." But not as much has been written about leading ourselves. For many, this may even be a new concept. We can see why there is a need for leadership when it comes to accomplishing things with others. But why do we need to lead ourselves? What does that even mean? The difference between leadership and management. We can see the need for personal leadership, as well as what it means, when we see how leadership differs from management. Most of us tend to conflate the two concepts, resulting in a bit of confusion. Management is a relatively familiar concept. It is about creating order and keeping things in that order. The stoplight at the intersection is a good example of management. It keeps traffic in order. It keeps people from running into each other. Or consider the discipline of time management. When you stay on task with your day, you are managing your time well. Management is so essential to getting unstuck that we'll be talking about personal management in part 3 of this book. But what about when you need to change things? How do you do that? Management simply will not work because change, by definition, involves some things being out of order, at least for a time. And so you need a fundamentally different skill to create change. Beyond that, what about purpose? Even when we are bringing things into order and keeping them in order, we need to know the purpose of that order, the direction in which to point it. And where do you get motivation? To go back to the traffic light example, what the traffic light cannot do is motivate people. It doesn't get them going. It helps keep them organized once they are moving, but it doesn't get them out in the street in the first place. All of these things, change, purpose, and motivation, are the domain of leadership. They are what leadership does. Leadership is like gas in your car. It provides the fuel for action, which takes the form of passion and motivation. And it provides direction so that you know where to go and aren't just wandering aimlessly. Why personal leadership matters so much. In What's Best Next, I went into detail on the distinction between effectiveness, doing the right things, and efficiency, doing things quickly. That is an echo of the distinction between leadership and management. Leadership corresponds to effectiveness. Management corresponds to efficiency. Thus, personal leadership is essential because it brings us into the realm of effectiveness. Personal management is not enough for the same reason that efficiency is not enough. Doing things faster and more in control will not suffice if you are going the wrong direction. Personal leadership is also essential because, like public leadership, it is the tool for making change. In this case, the change is in ourselves. When you want to change things about yourself or your life, personal leadership is the tool. Leadership sets the direction for change and motivates you through it, while personal management is about implementing and executing the change. One other reason worth noting why personal leadership matters so much is this. It is the necessary foundation for public leadership. We have to get this order right, and many leadership problems in society arise from getting it wrong. Stephen Covey says it best. Private victory precedes public victory. Personal leadership, being able to lead yourself with genuine integrity, is the private victory. We cannot lead others truly unless we can first lead ourselves authentically. Personal leadership comes before interpersonal and public leadership. The key to getting unstuck. How does using personal leadership to get ourselves unstuck fall short? Soon after I finished seminary and was working in my first full-time ministry position, I got a Franklin planner and tried to develop my mission statement. But it was not as helpful as I thought it would be. Only later did having a mission statement truly become helpful, when I understood more about what God's vision for us is as revealed in the scriptures. Often, we try to identify our mission mostly from reflection. That has its place. But the real power of vision comes when we understand more fully what God has revealed in the scriptures about His purposes, values, and strategy. When these truths settle deep in your thinking, developing your personal vision begins to flow. Moreover, I didn't understand why vision is so important and impactful. When I came to understand that, along with God's vision for our lives, vision started to come to life for me. We'll focus here on why vision is so powerful. For without grasping that, we will not know how to make effective use of it. The process of personal leadership for getting unstuck. So that you can see the big picture before we get into the details, this is the process for personal leadership that we will look at in part two. Vision. Understand the power of vision. Strategy. Be missional and understand how your faith and work relate. Mindset. See yourself as a professional. Preparation. Get the knowledge you need. Chapter 7. Understand the power of vision. Why vision is the most powerful force for getting unstuck, and why we need to make greater use of it if we are truly going to move toward God's purposes and do so together. The toil of a fool wearies him, for he does not know the way to the city. Ecclesiastes 10, verse 15. 6 years into his 33-year ministry at Bethlehem Baptist Church, John Piper wrote in his journal on November 6, 1986, "The church is looking for a vision for the future, and I do not have it. The one vision that the staff zeroed in on during our retreat Monday and Tuesday of this week, namely building a sanctuary, is so unattractive to me today that I do not see how I could provide the leadership and inspiration for it. Does this mean that my time at Bethlehem is over? Does it mean that there is a radical alternative unforeseen? Does it mean that I am simply in the pits today and unable to feel the beauty and power and joy and fruitfulness of an expanded facility and ministry? Oh Lord, have mercy on me. I am so discouraged. I am so blank. I feel like there are opponents on every hand, even when I know that most of my people are for me. I am so blind to the future of the church. I must preach on Sunday, and I can scarcely lift my head." John Piper, one of the most effective preachers in the history of the modern church, was stuck. Stuck from lack of vision. Why was Piper stuck? Because of issues surrounding vision. One of the most difficult yet important areas of leadership and personal effectiveness. Does Piper's experience mean that the entire enterprise of discovering a vision for a church or your life is misguided? Does it mean that trying to develop a vision leads only to discouragement because it is so hard to do? And is the concept of vision even necessary anyway? Developing a vision is incredibly difficult, and it is made more difficult by the ambiguity of terms surrounding the concept of vision and the general lack of clarity most of us have about its meaning. Later in the book, we will see how to overcome that fuzziness, for it is possible. More important right now, though, is the second issue. Is having a vision even necessary? And, for Christians, is it biblical? We might think that John Piper wouldn't endorse the need for vision, for he has been known to be skeptical of some concepts that may seem to come from the business world. Maybe concepts like vision are just tools of the business world and not relevant to the church and individuals. But notice that Piper did not go that direction. He did not even hint at that direction. His issue was entirely one of uncertainty about what the vision should be, not about whether there should be a vision. In fact, the primary reason that Piper was discouraged here was precisely because he did not have a vision for the church. And beyond that, others in the church had tentatively arrived at a vision that he did not find inspiring or meaningful. Lack of a shared vision, which Piper was confident to be God's vision for the church, was the cause of Piper's great discouragement. And so we see, from the negative side, the great importance of vision. Piper was stuck and discouraged because vision was lacking. He was so stuck and discouraged, in fact, that he almost quit. For that's what he titles the article where he recounts this journal entry. Nevertheless, he did not quit. He went on to preach at Bethlehem for 27 more years. More than that, Bethlehem went on to become one of the most well-known and influential churches in the nation. Piper's ministry touched a generation of millennials with a passion for God and a passion for missions, and expanded to reach millions online every month. How did Piper get unstuck? How did God unleash such blessing through his ministry? And so consistently year after year, so that today, even after retiring from his role at Bethlehem, he is writing and teaching more than ever before, and his ministry continues to expand online. Many components worked together to get Piper and his church unstuck. Perseverance was one of them. I am certainly not implying that Piper or the church was at fault or somehow flawed for not having clear vision at the time. We all go through a lack of clarity at times, and we need to know how to persevere even when our vision is not clear. We are not to let ourselves or our organizations languish without vision. That's not what Piper or his church did. The key component, after prayer, to how they got unstuck was that they persevered in developing a shared vision and succeeded. Unstuck through a compelling shared vision. Over a period of time, Piper and the other leaders developed a renewed vision for the church that gave the clarity, inspiration, and conviction they needed. When they received clarity on their mission, values, and ministry philosophy, they articulated these things in writing and wove them into the fabric of the church. Over the years, Piper has become one of the most effective vision casters in the entire North American church. Vision is central to his ministry and effectiveness, and vision can be central to your life, work, and ministry effectiveness as well. In fact, developing a clear vision is essential to getting unstuck, staying unstuck, and being the people God has called us to be. It is not simply something nice to do or a good idea to try out if we have time or are that sort of person. I will argue in this chapter that it is our responsibility to have a vision for our lives. The power of vision. There are two groups of people when it comes to the importance of vision. Some, and in my experience very few, don't think it matters much. The second group, on the other hand, are convinced of its importance and want to get on with the act of creating it. If most people are in the second group, why spend any time at all on why vision matters? The reason is that you can't unlock the power of vision in your life unless you first understand why vision is so powerful and so vital. You must first understand why developing vision is not just a good thing to do, but is your responsibility. When you grasp this concept, you gain a deeper commitment to living by your vision and a greater ability to live it out. Perhaps the biggest truth about why vision matters is this. Vision is essential for unlocking your full potential and achieving great things. It is, in fact, the most powerful tool for doing so. To understand this, we will look at examples of the power of vision in individuals, in times of suffering, and in teams. Then we will look at a few reasons why it is so powerful. Vision and true greatness. Don't be thrown off by the phrase achieving great things here. You might think, I don't want to make a lot of money. I'm not looking to build a large organization, and I'm not trying to be famous. That's just fine, because that is not what I mean by great. As we saw in part one, those things, while not bad in themselves, are aspects of secondary greatness. They are aspects of outward success and not essential to having a meaningful life. What really matters is primary greatness, goodness of character, and making an impact to extend this goodness in the lives of those you encounter. Vision is essential for true greatness, properly understood, because vision is the definition of what true greatness is. What Jim Collins has said about companies and greatness is also true of individuals. Vision isn't necessary to make money. You can certainly create a profitable business without it. There are plenty of people who have made a lot of money, yet had no compelling vision. But if you want to do more than just make a lot of money, if you want to build an enduring great company, then you need a vision. Collins's point for organizations also holds true for individuals. If you want to do more than simply make money in your life or be well-liked, if you want to live a life that makes the kind of difference God wants you to make, then you need to have a vision. It is ironic that if you simply want to do what our culture often defines as success, namely, make money, vision is not necessary. But if you want to do something more than that, it is essential. Vision not only leads to the right kind of accomplishment in life, it also tends to lead to high accomplishment. By this, I don't mean that the endeavors in your life have to be vast. If that's not your vision, then that's probably not going to be a good way to go. What I do mean is that clear vision leads to performing at your potential, which is indeed a good thing and something you are designed to do. In fact, vision has been shown to be incredibly powerful in every aspect of life. Experience backs this fact, and it has been verified by studies. Consider the following. The power of vision in individuals. Peter Senge, author of The Fifth Discipline, notes that people with a high level of personal mastery share several basic characteristics. They have a special sense of purpose that lies behind their visions and goals. For such a person, a vision is a calling rather than simply a good idea. Likewise, Stephen Covey notes, one of my favorite essays is The Common Denominator of Success, written by E.M. Gray. He spent his life searching for the one denominator that all successful people share. He found it wasn't hard work, good luck, or astute human relations, though those were all important. The one factor that seemed to transcend all the rest was putting first things first. Putting first things first requires a vision. As Covey notes, discipline derives from disciple, disciple to a philosophy, disciple to a set of principles, disciple to a set of values, disciple to an overriding purpose, to a superordinate goal, or a person who represents that goal. In other words, you cannot put first things first unless you know what first things are. And it's your vision that defines them. The power of vision in suffering. Perhaps the greatest illustration of the power of vision in individuals' lives is that of Viktor Frankl, the Austrian psychologist who survived the Nazi death camps of World War II. During his time in the concentration camps, he was sustained by his vision of reuniting with his wife and lecturing after the war on the psychological lessons learned from the concentration camps. He also observed how others endured, intrigued by the question of why anyone at all survived when most did not. Stephen Covey summarizes his findings very well. Frankl looked at several factors: health, vitality, family, structure, intelligence, survival skills. Finally, he concluded that none of these factors was primarily responsible. The single most significant factor, he realized, was a sense of future vision, the impelling conviction of those who were to survive that they had a mission to perform, some important work left to do. Survivors of POW camps in Vietnam and elsewhere have reported similar experiences. A compelling, future-oriented vision is the primary force that kept many of them alive. Frankl summarized his experiences and his approach to psychology that resulted from it in his classic book, Man's Search for Meaning. In the foreword to the 1992 edition, Harold Kushner writes, "Frankl describes poignantly those prisoners who gave up on life, who had lost all hope for a future, and were inevitably the first to die. They died less from lack of food or medicine than from lack of hope, lack of something to live for." He then summarizes Frankl's central conclusion from his observations and research, and it is about the centrality of vision. Life is not primarily a quest for pleasure, as Freud believed, or a quest for power, as Alfred Adler taught, but a quest for meaning. The greatest task for any person is to find meaning in his or her life. Vision answers that quest for meaning. Frankl's example, and that of other prisoner of war survivors, shows that vision is so powerful that it motivates and sustains even through the greatest suffering. Research reveals that part of the reason vision sustains is that it provides an internal locus of control that cannot be swept away by external hardships. Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi writes in his classic book, Flow, "Research into the writings of survivors of extreme conditions, such as Viktor Frankl and Bruno Bettelheim, has led some to the conclusion that the most important trait of survivors is a non-self-conscious individualism, or a strongly directed purpose that is not self-seeking. People who have that quality are bent on doing their best in all circumstances, yet they are not concerned primarily with advancing their own interests. Because they are intrinsically motivated in their actions, they are not easily disturbed by external threats. With enough psychic energy free to observe and analyze their surroundings objectively, they have a better chance of discovering in them new opportunities for action. If we were to consider one trait a key element of the autotelic personality, this might be it." In other words, vision is an affirmation of the one thing that no circumstances or concentration camp torturer can ever take away: a person's ability to choose how to respond to a situation. Then, in addition to that, while preserving an internal locus of control and freedom, it also provides external focus, which is essential to not having too tight of a grip. If you do not have an external focus, that is, if you are narcissistic, you become isolated within yourself. Certainly the vision of some people is themselves, but that is not the type of vision I am affirming here. The kind of vision God advocates for us is by definition outward focused and others oriented, and so inclines you to center your attention on good things beyond yourself. The power of vision in teams. Teams with a vision also perform better. Abraham Maslow is well known as one of the most significant psychologists of the last century. His research into high-performing teams found that the most striking characteristic of these teams was shared vision and purpose. In his excellent book, Start With Why, Simon Sinek shows that vision is why the Wright brothers succeeded in being the first to build an airplane that could fly. It is a very interesting story, for there was another person who set out to build an airplane at the same time, and he was much better funded. His name was Samuel Pierpont Langley, and he was seemingly armed with every ingredient for success. Langley was a professor at Harvard and senior officer at the Smithsonian. He was given a grant of $50,000 from the War Department, which is many million in today's dollars, and assembled a team of some of the best talent of the day. Further, the press followed his every move as the nation closely followed his story. He had all the ingredients that conventional wisdom would say bring success. But Langley was not the first to pilot an airplane, and in fact, gave up his aim to do it altogether when the Wright brothers beat him to it. The Wright brothers did not have the equipping and support that Langley had. Quite the contrary. There were no government grants for their endeavor or other forms of external funding. They funded it out of their own earnings from their bicycle shop. No one on their team was regarded as being among the great minds of the day. In fact, no one on their team even had a college education. Yet, it was the less equipped, less noticed Wright brothers who were the first to take flight in human history. Not the better funded, more prominent Samuel Pierpont Langley. Why? Cynic tells the story in his book, but here is his conclusion. It wasn't luck. Both the Wright brothers and Langley were highly motivated. Both had a strong work ethic. Both had keen scientific minds. They were pursuing exactly the same goal, but only the Wright brothers were able to inspire those around them and truly lead their team to develop a technology that would change the world. Only the Wright brothers started with why. In other words, the Wright brothers succeeded because they had vision. In Cynic's words, they started with why. Some might say, Langley had a vision also, to be the first to pilot an airplane. But such a view misunderstands the concept of vision. As we will see, vision is not just about the what. It is even more about the why. In other words, why is an essential component of vision, and Langley overlooked it. Cynic himself experienced the power of vision in his own life. He was at a point in his life when he was making a good living, working with great clients, and doing his work well. He writes that, "By all superficial measurements, I should have been happy." But he wasn't. He wasn't fulfilled by his work, and he said, "I found myself in a very dark place." That's when Cynic discovered the power of vision, or what in his book he calls starting with why. He writes, "The discovery of why completely changed my view of the world, and discovering my own why restored my passion to a degree multiple times greater than at any other time in my life." Vision is recognized across disciplines, including psychology. Finally, I find it significant that the central role of vision in living a meaningful life is formally acknowledged and accepted in philosophy and modern psychology. In other words, there is multidisciplinary recognition of the power of vision, not just from self-development, but also from the studies of suffering, business, philosophy, and psychology. In noting the place of vision in psychology, Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi first notes its place in philosophy. Philosophers like Heidegger, Sartre, and Merleau-Ponty have recognized this task of modern man by calling it the project, which is their term for the goal-directed actions that provide shape and meaning to an individual's life. Then he makes the connection to his field, psychology. Psychologists have used terms like appropriate strivings, or life themes. In each case, these concepts identify a set of goals linked to an ultimate goal that gives significance to whatever a person does. In his own research, Csikszentmihalyi notes that people who find their lives meaningful usually have a goal that is challenging enough to take up all their energies, a goal that can give significance to their lives. We may refer to this process as achieving purpose. Having a central goal is important, he argues, for achieving unity and harmony of consciousness. He points out that as long as enjoyment follows piecemeal from activities not linked to one another in a meaningful way, one is still vulnerable to the vagaries of chaos. But if a person sets out to achieve a difficult enough goal, from which all other goals logically follow, and if he or she invests all energy in developing skills to reach that goal, then actions and feelings will be in harmony, and the separate parts of life will fit together, and each activity will make sense in the present, as well as in view of the past and of the future. In such a way, it is possible to give meaning to one's entire life. And once again, lest we think having a guiding goal is simply a luxury for some, Csikszentmihalyi points out that having such a goal has always been recognized by society as part of being a mature adult. He notes, "Someone who knows his desires and works with purpose to achieve them is a person whose feelings, thoughts, and actions are congruent with one another, and is therefore a person who has achieved inner harmony. In the 1960s, this process was called getting your head together. But in practically every other historical period, a similar concept has been used to describe this necessary step toward living a good life. Developing an overall vision for your life, then, is simply part of being an adult. Perhaps the failure of so many to deeply think through their vision these days is a reflection of the wider societal trend toward perpetual adolescence. That is an impoverished existence." Csikszentmihalyi then notes the personal benefit of having a clear vision. Inner congruence ultimately leads to that inner strength and serenity we admire in people who seem to have come to terms with themselves. Why vision is so powerful. Vision enables us to operate from the importance paradigm rather than the urgency paradigm in three ways. First, in part one, we argued that crucial to getting unstuck and being truly productive is to shift from the urgency paradigm to the importance paradigm. But how do you make this shift? How do you know what's important? You need to have criteria. Your vision is that criteria. It is your picture and definition of what is truly important and where you are going, and therefore it is essential to operating from the importance paradigm. In other words, we saw that productivity is not just organizing and executing around priorities. It is organizing and executing around the right priorities. That is personal effectiveness in a nutshell. Your vision is what enables you to clearly determine what the right priorities are. It gives you concrete criteria for knowing what is important, and thus, moment-by-moment importance-based direction. As Covey notes, vision empowers us to put first things first, compasses ahead of clocks, people ahead of schedules and things. Creating and integrating an empowering personal mission statement is one of the most important quadrant two investments we can make. Second, vision also gets us beyond reactive living. Without vision, it is all too easy to live reactively instead of proactively. We let crises, firefighting, and unconsidered opportunities guide and direct us rather than maintaining a deliberate approach to life. Related to this, Andy Stanley notes how vision provides the power of focus. A clear vision has the power to bring what's most important to the surface of your schedule and lifestyle. A clear vision makes it easy to weed out of your life those things that stand in the way of achieving what matters most. Vision empowers you to move purposefully in a predetermined direction. Once you have clarified your vision or visions, many decisions are already made. Without vision, good things will hinder you from achieving the best things. Third, vision enables us to get beyond the control perspective to the release perspective. As we saw, we often think that the way to get things done and to change is to impose a tight regimen on ourselves. But that's the control perspective, which is based on extrinsic motivation, and therefore lacks the power to truly motivate us. Covey writes that vision enables intrinsic motivation, and thus the release perspective that pulls us toward our goals rather than pushes us. Without the passion of vision, discipline is regimentation and restraint. Control yourself, grit your teeth, white-knuckle your way through life. The basic paradigm is that without some form of tight control, we'll mess up. We don't have trust in ourselves that, left to our own internal motivation, we would moment by moment make effective choices. But the passion of vision releases the power that connects discipline with its root word, disciple. We become followers of our own internal imperatives, voluntarily subordinating the less important to that deep-burning yes. Instead of control, we're focused on release. The key to motivation is motive. It's the why. It's the deeper yes, burning inside, that makes it easier to say no to the less important. Vision gets us into the release perspective because it draws us rather than pushes us. It draws us because it captures our imagination and taps into higher purpose, which gives it the potential to engage our hearts. As Andy Stanley writes, "Once our hearts have felt the energy that comes with the well-cast vision, we gain a sense of destiny. Hence, vision serves as intrinsic motivation. We move in the direction of the vision because we want to, not because we are told to. Instead of pushing and cajoling us into action, a vision draws and even enchants us. Vision is the fundamental driver of human action." Vision, according to Stephen Covey, is the fundamental force that drives everything else in our lives. Elsewhere, he echoes this. "More than any other factor, vision affects the choices we make and the way we spend our time. Essential to the motivating force of vision is that it needs to be outward focused, on contribution and others, rather than on yourself." Daniel Pink notes from his research on purpose that "the most deeply motivated people, not to mention those who are most productive and satisfied, hitch their desires to a cause larger than themselves. People with a sense of vision are more enthusiastic and fulfilled. They are more energetic, courageous, and persevering." Andy Stanley notes that "vision-driven people are motivated people. Find me a man or woman who lacks motivation, and I'll show you someone with little or no vision." Vision evokes emotion. One of the reasons vision ignites passion is that it evokes emotion. Because it paints a picture of the future, it taps into the imagination and emotional side of human nature. Andy Stanley notes, "A clear, focused vision actually allows us to experience ahead of time the emotions associated with our anticipated future. Hence, the clearer the vision, the stronger the emotion. Emotions, in turn, reinforce our commitment to the vision." Because of the motivation and clarity vision gives, it enables you to overcome many obstacles, including internal ones. Vision gives you the passion that enables you to transcend fear, doubt, discouragement, and many other things that keep us from accomplishment and contribution. Senge also points out the place of vision in creating courage. "Shared visions compel courage so naturally that people don't even realize the extent of their courage. Courage is simply doing whatever is needed in pursuit of the vision, despite the obstacles and fear." Vision provides fulfillment. Vision not only provides motivation, it also provides meaning and fulfillment. We saw this in Dan Pink's quote before, as well as in Csikszentmihalyi's observation that "people who find their lives meaningful usually have a goal that is challenging enough to take up all their energies, a goal that can give significance to their lives." Andy Stanley captures this idea well. A vision gives you a reason to get up in the morning. If you don't show up, something important won't be accomplished. Suddenly, you matter. As a result, a good vision that syncs with people's own values forms the basis of extraordinary human effort. Jim Collins summarizes this, capturing perhaps the most fundamental reason vision is so powerful. "Human beings respond to values, ideals, dreams, and exhilarating challenges. It's our nature. We will go to phenomenal lengths in an effort to live up to the ideals of our organization, peer group, or society if we share those ideals and consider them worthy. Managers who build their organizations based on a set of worthy values, sound beliefs, and a compelling mission are laying the groundwork for extraordinary human effort. Most people want to do more than bring home a paycheck. They want work they can believe in and that has meaning. This may not be true of all people, but it's certainly true of the people most likely to be solid contributors to a great company. Tap into the basic human desire for meaningful work, and the traditional management problem of how to motivate employees largely evaporates. People will be self-motivated when doing work they believe in.